The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Sean Carroll and Dan Orlowitz return to round up a slightly abbreviated J1 Matchday 16 played over the weekend, while we'll also field some questions from our Patreon supporters and touch on Japan at the Copa America and the Women's World Cup. The J-Talk Podcast starts now. It's always great to welcome Dan and Sean back to the pod. Firstly, Dan, how are you?
Great. Good to be back.
Terrific to have you on again, Dan. And, Sean, welcome back to you as well. How are things?
Very good, thanks. Very good. Too much football going on at the moment, but I guess we shouldn't complain.
No, it's a wonderful time of the year. So I mentioned in the intro that J1 played an abbreviated schedule over the weekend. That's because the four ACL clubs had the weekend off in between the two legs of the round of 16 of that competition. So let's get our any other business done right off the top, gents. Last Tuesday, Kashima beat Hiroshima 1-0 thanks to a Serginho goal in the 24th minute, with the Sanfrecce's Sho Inagaki sent off 4 minutes from time, while on Wednesday, Urawa lost 2-1 at home to Ulsan of South Korea. The South Korean outfit getting the winner with 10 minutes to go. The return legs are on the same days this week, with the Kashima and Hiroshima then meeting again in the league this Sunday in match day 17. Before these games in hand from the weekend, Hiroshima versus Kawasaki and Urawa versus Kashima are played on Wednesday, July the 31st. So a brief word on the ACL, guys. Sean, obviously the past two ACL champions are involved here, but of them, Urawa certainly have the far harder task ahead of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I heard somewhere that Ulsan certainly haven't lost at home in this year's ACL. They might even not have conceded, but that's just something I heard somewhere. So, they've got an incredibly hard task now going away and trying to turn that round, not least because they've looked absolutely terrible of late. You wouldn't fancy them going away and beating any of the teams in J1 in their current form. So, that certainly looks like an uphill task for them. And Kashima, they got the 1-0 win at home. They didn't concede the away goal. When you're playing teams from the same country, it doesn't really make a difference if you're home or away. I think when you've got the travel to a different country, you're playing against opponents you're not so used to, like Reds are going to have to do. There is an extra element of difficulty, but Antlers know exactly what Hiroshima are all about and vice versa. And I think they'll be, obviously it's only a one goal lead, but I think they'll be confident that they can do enough in the Big Arch, or whatever it's called now, Edion. Got to show my age there.
It's still a big arch for purposes of the ACL, isn't it?
Oh, okay, there you go. So I'm doing my bit for the AFC's sponsorship wing. That's good.
Indeed. So, Dan, Hiroshima had broken out of their J1 funk with a home win over Shonan in their last league game. Do you give them a chance of overturning that first leg deficit against Antlers?
Sure, I do. I think that, as Sean says, away and home don't really matter when it's a domestic ACL tie. And I don't think that Kashima are quite as invincible as they looked last season. And, I mean, Hiroshima, they're underperforming in the league this year, in my opinion. I mean, they're in eighth, but they're just not as strong as they were last year. And I don't know. I wouldn't count them out. Unfortunately, Hiroshima just don't have as much of a home advantage, considering just that so much of Edion is blocked off because of the AFC's chair regulation. So, yeah, it's not going to be the greatest of atmospheres, but any given Tuesday, really.
Most definitely. All right. So once again, it's a Hiroshima hosting Kashima on Tuesday night, and then Reds in South Korea to face Ulsan on the Wednesday. All right, so let's cover Japan at these two international competitions, guys, and we're doing this at the start of the episode mainly so I don't forget at the end. So, yes, we'll start with the Samurai Blue at the Copa America. Some of our worst fears were confirmed in their Group C opener, where obviously a vastly inexperienced Japan side was swept aside 4-0 by Chile. But after Hajime Moriyasu rung the changes, the Samurai Blue were vastly improved in their second match against Uruguay last Friday morning, Japan time. Twice taking the lead through Koji Miyoshi before having to settle for a VAR-assisted 2-2 draw. I mean, Dan, this says it's not even a B team, is it, for Japan? It's a YTH team. It's a youth team with the Olympics in mind, with a couple of veterans thrown in for experience, your Kawashimas and your Okazakis. And yeah, I must admit, I was not really surprised by the loss to Chile in the first game, but very, very pleasantly surprised by the fight back and the performance that Japan put in against Uruguay. That took me by surprise, and it was a very merited result for Japan.
I honestly think that as far as the Chile game is concerned, they didn't deserve to win, certainly. They probably did deserve to lose, but I think that 4-0 was a bit harsh, maybe not indicative of how well they played in that game, relatively speaking. And the Uruguay game, yeah, it was great. I think they played well. They had the veteran leadership on the pitch in terms of Kawashima being in goal. We've always joked that he'll maybe die between the posts for Japan, but for our sins, that could be what we get. And yeah, Okazaki's out there, and that's all well and good. I wouldn't complain if he was an overage player next year. And I think that Moriyasu was getting what he wants out of this tournament. So he's getting a good look at the youngsters in decently competitive games, and it'll give him more to think over heading into 2020.
So, Sean, Miyoshi obviously grabbed the headlines in the second game. I mean, his first goal was an absolute belter. I mean, he can't even get in the Yokohama team in the last month or 6 weeks or so. But that was a terrific performance from him. Was there anybody else, maybe a couple of players that caught your eye, especially against Uruguay, that won't have done their, not only their Olympic prospects, but maybe their chances of making some more full Daihyo squads in the next few months? They might have done their chances any harm?
No, I don't. To be honest, I don't think anyone's really stood out. I think I agree with Dan. I think against I'm going to have to join you guys in calling them Chile. Against Chile, they I don't think they played as badly as 4-0 suggests. But I also think they were pretty bad in the aspects that you need to be good at these kind of competitions, that are the things that Japan often lack at. You know, at both ends of the pitch, the defending was pretty shambolic at times. They were really giving up chances far too easily. And at the other end, poor old Ueda had a debut to forget. I think he missed at least three very, very good chances. You could possibly say another one. So you could possibly give him four. So I think that was I don't really like saying this, but it was a good lesson for them, you know, these younger players, to realise that ultimately that's what it comes down to at these kind of competitions. And I think against Uruguay, they were obviously stitched up by that horrific decision for the penalty. But I think on the balance of play, although they did do well to take a point from the game, I think, you know, Uruguay hit the post, I think, two, maybe three times. Like they probably should have lost the game. Even if you take away the penalty that never should have been. But they've looked steady enough, you know. They're doing the things that Japan always do. They're all pretty confident on the ball. They all tried to play the right way. They were getting a bit panicky as the game wore on against Uruguay. I would have quite liked them to have sort of put their foot on the ball a bit more and played their way out, and they were just sort of hacking it away and therefore keeping themselves penned back. But no, I don't think anyone, like you said, obviously Miyoshi did well, he got the couple of goals, but I don't think anyone so far has really, really staked a claim to say, look, I'm ready to be involved with the top team, or I'm going to shine at the Olympics next year.
All right, Dan, before we move on, do you want to have a crack at that as well? Has anybody really caught your eye, or do you agree with Sean's assessment there?
I mostly agree. I mean, Kubo was pretty decent against Chile, but, you know, we know that he's good, and his move to Madrid will help him progress. I don't think that we're in a particular rush to see him start playing in the World Cup qualifiers in September. I think we got to play the long game. I think you have to look at not just the performance of this squad, but also the performance of the Toulon team, the performance of the under-20s in Poland, to get a clearer picture of what Japan's next generation of players is going to look at. And that's going to take some time to evaluate those players in retrospect and also to see them develop over the next 2 or 3 years.
Sorry, can I just jump back in quickly?
Of course.
Just something Dan said there, I'm not entirely sure this move to Madrid will help Kubo develop. I don't know. It's obviously he's moving to one of, if not the biggest clubs in the world, but they don't have an especially good reputation for developing these youngsters. It looks to me from the outside almost like something they've done partly just to give a bit of a black eye to Barcelona to stop them getting him back. You know, it's been, depending on which reports you read, either an incredibly low transfer fee or none at all. So they've got very little to lose. And he's going to be playing in the B team, which, is that going to do him any good? Would he have been better to go to a team lower down in, you know, play for a first team in La Liga? Right. We're talking about he's only 18, he's still young, whatever. But in Europe, that isn't so out of the ordinary for players of that age to be playing regularly in the first team. And I'm not sure I certainly don't think he should have stayed at Tokyo. I think the time was right for him to get back to Europe, but I'm not entirely sure that moving to such a huge club is gonna do him any good. But we'll see. I guess, you know, we'll have to wait maybe 2 years from now. We'll see if he's really kicked on or if his career sort of stalls a bit because of it.
All right, fair enough then. So, well said to the pair of you. That means, of course, that that result against Uruguay means that Japan's qualification for the quarterfinals is still very much a possibility heading into the final group stage match against Ecuador with the game taking place Tuesday morning Japan time. So, you already know the score, dear listener, and you know that if Japan have won, they are through. And if they are through, it's almost certain that they will face host Brazil, which would be absolutely fascinating in the quarterfinals. We very much hope that Japan have gotten the 3 points against Ecuador. As I say, you already know what happened, but we don't, as we record on Monday night Japan time. A draw obviously would not have been enough if that's the result they got, and if they lost, well, then they already knew they were on their way home. I mentioned in the intro we're going to have some questions from our Patreon supporters. Let's get to the first of those now, and it comes from Nick Walker. It's quite a long one, guys, but Nick is asking about the position that he's worried about the most when it comes to the next World Cup cycle for the Japan national team, and that is at fullback. He says that every other position group has seen experimentation and an injection of youth, some with positive results, Takehiro Tomiyasu being one, and others that not so much, thinking about Koya Kitagawa at the Asian Cup. He concedes that Hajime Moriyasu has experimented at fullback. The back three with wingbacks in the recent friendlies was an interesting wrinkle, but he believes that just highlights how little depth there is behind Yuto Nagatomo and Hiroki Sakai. So, Nick is wondering, guys, is there a systematic or tactical issue that is stunting fullback development in Japan? Who's got their hand up and who wants to answer that first? Crickets. Okay.
I'll take it sort of from the goalkeeping perspective. There's a couple issues at play. One is that I think just physically, Japan isn't developing the kind of players who play at goalkeeper. You know, you need a big tall boy with a really, really quick reaction speed and a good sense, you know, and that good leadership sense, and, you know, someone who can be calm, cool, and collected. And, you know, Kawashima can be two out of three of those things at any given time. If you look at who our top crop of goalkeepers is right now, what's the depth chart? I guess Daniel Schmidt is our number one. Is that who we're with at this point? Him or Kawashima?
It appears to be.
Shuichi Gonda. You know, who knows what happened to Kosuke Nakamura? We don't know if he's still in the picture or not, or if that most recent concussion sort of did it in for him. Are we going to bring Akihiro Hayashi back into the fold? Are we going to bring back Shusaku Nishikawa? Like, what's going on here? And goalkeeping is a tough position, and it's not being made any easier by the fact that right now so many of the better goalkeepers in the J League are Korean. And I think there's a couple European and Central American goalkeepers in the mix as well, but the point is that it's already a position where there isn't room. You can be a second string defender or midfielder or striker and still get playing time, but it's much more difficult if for the goalkeeper position. So it's tough, and I don't know if there is a solution for it. I think the ideal solution is to get more goalkeepers overseas, but as we've seen, that's easier said than done.
All right, so that's Dan's take on the goalkeeping position. Sean, what about in relation to Nick's question there? I mean, Nick did actually ask a little bit about keeper and striker, and that was basically the one sentence I omitted from his question, and Dan's gone and answered that, talking about the goalkeeping spot. But what about at fullback? Do you have any sort of theories about why we aren't seeing the next Nagatomo, why we aren't seeing the next Sakai coming through? Because, I mean, there are decent fullbacks at J1 level, but maybe they just haven't quite made that next step through to the full national team.
Yeah, I think it's something that maybe... I think Nagatomo obviously is more of an issue because he is, what, mid-30s now? 34, maybe? Coming up 34, 33?
Yeah.
He is one that is more of a concern. I mean, if he's fit, he starts and he should start. And yeah, his energy levels, his ability is not diminishing. He's still clearly the first option out wide on the left. But yeah, at his age, there's every chance he might start picking up knocks. There's every chance that you know, he only needs to get one, even if it's a fairly minor injury. If there's something that snaps, it's going to be much harder. It's going to take him longer to come back. And, you know, at his age, that's a concern looking ahead to the next World Cup. Sakai, I think, is still only 29, maybe, just 29. So I think for him, we're still fairly settled with him. And I think, yeah, there shouldn't be too many concerns. I know, obviously, you always want to have strength in depth, but I almost think that's more of an issue for club teams than national sides. I think with a national team, if you've got as much as possible, you kind of want to have your best 11 nailed down. Yeah, of course, there's going to be issues with injuries and stuff, but you haven't got the same grind as you have with a club. You need someone to cover because very few players can play the 34, 40-odd games that are required throughout the season. But yeah, like you said, there are players, you know, the likes of, I don't know, Yamanaka or Koki Anzai are decent players in the J League. They're still relatively young, but personally, I think, yeah, they need to be moving abroad. Nagatomo and Sakai both moved abroad, I would say in their early, certainly mid-20s. They were probably no older than 23, 24 when they made the move. And that now is absolutely vital for the level that Japan want to be playing at. They don't want to just be qualifying for World Cups now. They want to be getting through to the knockout stage and to the quarterfinals. And if you want to be playing at that level, you can't just be a JB player. You need to be playing regularly in a good European league. And yeah, at the moment it is a slight concern because, as you say, you look through the squad and he's tried out different issues. He tried, rather surprisingly, he played Junya Ito and Genki Haraguchi as the wide players, which again could be an option if he's going to stick to this three at the back formation throughout the World Cup qualifiers, and that's something that Moriyasu wants to stick with. He does tend to prefer attackers. When he was at Hiroshima, he tended to prefer attack-minded players who can also defend rather than defenders who can get forward. If you think of, he had a Mikic and it was probably Kashiwa, maybe, out wide when he was at Hiroshima. And these guys are players you think more of as kind of right-wingers or left-wingers, but who also put in a shift and put the running in to get back. So it could be something that he's thinking of, that maybe the likes of Haraguchi could do a job if pushed into those roles. But yeah, I agree that when you do sort of scan through the squads in the J League or you look at the players who are in Europe, if either or both of Sakai or Nagatomo were to pick up severe injuries or if their form was to really badly drop off, there's certainly no one who immediately jumps out that you think, well, he could just come in and there wouldn't really be a dip in form.
Yeah, I wonder, Yamanaka was one that I was going to mention, and obviously he would have expected his move to Reds to, kick his career along, and so far he's found life fairly difficult at Saitama Stadium, and obviously not having the freedom he enjoyed with Yokohama. But I wonder, guys, whether somebody, and again, this is a fairly left-field shout, but whether somebody like Kyogo Furuhashi at Kobe, who's somebody we mentioned quite a bit from time to time on this podcast, and we have ever since he was at Gifu, of course, with Stuart Smith's connection to the pod, I wonder whether he should just go to Thorsten Fink one day at training and say, hey, Thorsten, give me a few training sessions at fullback and let me, and have a look at me and see what you reckon, because there's going to be a gap in the Japan national team in the next couple of years when Nagatomo is forced to retire. And if nobody else really stakes a claim for that spot, then somebody who converts himself into a really good left back could perhaps take a crack at the job. And I don't want to spout my Liverpool fandom on this podcast too much, but I mean somebody like Trent Alexander-Arnold, who was 17, 18 years old and wanted to work his way into the Liverpool first team. Well, he knew he wasn't going to be able to do it as a central midfielder, which is what he came up through the youth system at Liverpool as. So he basically started training as a right back, and now he started the last two European Cup finals. So I mean somebody like Furuhashi, there's probably loads of other names out there who could sort of take a similar punt. And I mean, we know how effective Furuhashi can be going forward. But I mean, yeah, you throw him at left back for a couple of games and see if he sinks or swims. I don't know. Something like that could be a really left field shout. And I don't know. Call me crazy. I was hoping that Takashi Usami was going to go to FC Tokyo. I never saw anything about it in the media. It was just a crazy theory I had. Maybe this is just another one of those. But something that maybe Furuhashi could consider, his coach could consider, or even Hajime Moriyasu could consider somewhere down the line. I don't know if either you guys got a reaction to that or you went and sent me to the mental institution. But, I don't know. Something's got to be done, I guess, and that's what Nick's question is getting at as well. So whether it's something as left field as that, I'm not sure.
I think Furuhashi could do a job if Moriyasu goes with the sort of 3-4-2-1. I think if he does stick with 4-4-2, I'm not sure you want someone, because he's clearly a very attack-minded player. He doesn't mind putting a shift in and getting stuck in defensively, but I'm not sure if positionally, discipline-wise, he would be able to make that switch. Again, we don't know. As you said, there are players who have done that and adapted their play style, but I think he's such a threat going forward and seems to play so instinctively going forwards. I think if you were talking about 3-4-2-1 and he was out wide on the left and maybe you had, you know, Sakai or Haraguchi or someone out wide on the right, it could work. But I'm not sure if that would work as a 4-4-2 or a 4, whatever it is, 4-2-3-1 or whatever. If it was a flat back 4, I'm not 100%.
No, fair enough then. All right, well, it was a very fairly random shout, so probably took you both by surprise there. But, thanks very much for your question, Nick, and your ongoing support on Patreon as well. So, okay, don't worry, listeners. We are, of course, getting to the J1 portion of this podcast. But before we do, let's just quickly chat about Nadeshko Japan at the Women's World Cup. Japan will play the Netherlands in the early hours of Wednesday morning in the round of 16 of the Women's World Cup after finishing second in Group D following a 2-0 loss to England. I'll tell you what, though, Dan, it looks to me like the silver lining of that loss, while it would be foolish, of course, to look beyond Holland, is that Japan's half of the draw, Germany aside, who they wouldn't face as well until the semi-finals, is lacking any of the tournament favourites. I mean, the USA, France and England are all on the other side of the bracket, and Canada and Sweden, who are also in the top 10 of the FIFA rankings, play each other before the winner faces Germany in the quarters. So it's, I don't know, it's pretty much laid out in front of Asako Takakura side, isn't it?
Yeah, I was looking at the bracket this morning, and I was pretty much thinking the same thing. I think that if you can get past Holland, we're going to be a tough opponent for the men's or women's World Cup, just in any competition. You've got Italy or China up next, and I think that they're very beatable opponents for Nadeshko. I think that the pathway to the semis and maybe the final is clear. The question is what happens when they get to the final. And I don't know. So far, I haven't seen anything to show me that Japan is capable of beating the U.S., for example, as dominant as they've been so far this tournament. And even England are just very strong. And you saw how they got past Cameroon last night and just how confident they were, even though they were sort of dealing with a team that brought its own baggage to the proceedings. And I don't know. It's tough. I think that I want to say it doesn't take it does take a lot to get to the finals of the Women's World Cup. But, you know, if you're looking at a very stacked opposite side of the bracket, I don't know, this might not be our year.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. Sean, obviously winning it in 2011 and then making the final again in 2015. I mean, the kickoff times have been pretty horrendous for us in Japan to watch these games live and then get on with our daily lives when most other people do. So I'm not sure how much you've seen of the group stage. But, yeah, I guess Japan have made it through in a workmanlike fashion. But, again, that loss to England, it seems to have worked in their favour when you look at the way that the bracket's laid out in front of them.
Yeah, I have to admit, and likewise, I've not seen any of it yet because, yeah, with Copa America, with J-League going on, and as you mentioned, the fact that, although from the outside it might not look like it, we have lives as well. We do have to do other things. So it's been hard to try and fit it in. I was tempted to watch the England game, but once I knew both teams were through, I thought I'd sort of save myself for later on in the tournament. I think one thing, looking sort of very much from the outside and not having seen a great deal of the Japanese women's team recently, looking at it from a sort of a bigger perspective, a lot of other countries now, I guess what you'd call bigger, more established footballing countries, since Japan won it maybe in 2011, have really started to treat the women's game more seriously in terms of the level of organisation, the level of investment and things. And I think what we're finding is these kind of countries, you know, you could say France and England and these countries are now getting to the point where maybe Japan were at when they were winning the tournament. Japan have been sort of, they've invested and they've treated the women's game, all right, not on a par with the men's. And we've obviously had those issues where the women were flying economy and the men weren't and all these little things. But the levels of organization and the sort of the grassroots level and the way that they organize things in the JFA for the women's team have been at that at a high level for a long time. And I think now that other countries are starting to catch up, Japan is maybe going to find it more difficult. You know, there's going to be more competition for them. I think when you look back at when they won it, there was maybe four or five, possibly six teams that would be getting to the semi-finals every time. I think now it's a bigger pool. There are more countries coming through. And obviously this time Japan have gone with quite a young side. They're obviously trying to build, I guess similarly with what the men's team are doing with the Copa America, they're trying to build with one eye looking ahead to the Olympics. I think the Olympics is the one, as we know, you know, in Japan, the Olympics is, the Olympics football is a big deal for people in Japan, for the JFA and for the Japanese fans, which maybe it might not be for, you know, fans from other countries, but who focus more on the World Cup is the main one. So I think, again, it's maybe they're looking ahead with one eye, given a bit of experience. But yeah, they've got a decent enough draw now. I don't think hopes were especially high ahead of this competition. I think that obviously they wanted to get as far as possible, but I think they're also, I believe, planning to pay, place a bid for the next Women's World Cup. So I'm wondering if maybe they're looking now to lay the foundations for the Olympics next year, for the next World Cup, if it's in Japan, and really maybe trying to just lay the base now rather than targeting success this time around.
Japan is one of, I think, eight or so countries bidding for the 2023 Women's World Cup. And really, if you look at the other countries, I think you can compare Japan with Australia, who have a really strong bid. And I think I've heard South Africa has a pretty strong bid. And other than that, it's mostly there's the joint Korea bid, which I don't really take very seriously, and then a bunch of South American countries were bidding, who I take even less seriously. I do think that Nedesco Japan has such a good reputation overseas. I think that there's a lot of goodwill towards women's football in Japan, and I personally, I'm not a betting man, but I think that the 2023 World Cup is Japan's for the taking. So yeah, I agree with Sean. It is about putting in a good performance at this tournament, even if they don't win, even getting to the semifinals and maybe winning the third place game or getting to the final, and then doing so at the Olympics next year, will make the team look really good going forward. And we do have to remember, something that all of us combined probably watch much less, but, Japan's underage women's team, teams, I should say, have a very strong record. They won the under-17 Women's World Cup relatively recently. I think that was in 2017. And we have a lot of potential for the future.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so once again, yeah, Nedesco Japan face Netherlands on Wednesday morning Japan time, and we wish them all the best for that. As Dan mentioned, it'll be Italy or China in the quarters if they make it past the Dutch. All right then, dear listener. Well, we've made it about halfway through this podcast. We haven't talked about J1 yet. So, eagle-eared listeners probably realise that that has something to do with the FC Tokyo losing for the second straight game and indeed for the third time in the last 4 weeks. And apologies to any Sendai supporters listening who would normally be expecting us to begin the episode by talking about the league leaders, as we have done for pretty much the last 2 months. Well, I'm starting to realise that this is all going to come crashing down for Tokyo. So this week we are leading the J1 section of the podcast by talking about Yokohama hosting Matsumoto on Saturday night. And not the least because both of my guests were in attendance at the Nissan Stadium. And truth be told, I have wanted to do a bit of a deep dive on Matsumoto Yamaga for quite a while. One reason for that is that three of the podcast patrons are Matsumoto supporters, so I wanted to give them more coverage to go some way towards satisfying those people. But another is that I think that they're a team that everyone wants to see do well. I mean, we all know about the terrific support they enjoy both at home at the Allwind Stadium and on the road from their hordes of travelling fans. They are a club that has grown organically and done things, in inverted commas, the right way. But, Sean, I don't know, at the moment, we're obviously going to come on to talk about events on the pitch at the Nissan on Saturday night, But at this stage of the season, almost halfway through, it kind of appears to me that they haven't really learnt too many lessons from their first stint in J1. What was it, 3 or 4 years ago now?
Yeah, I think that is the thing. I spoke to their manager ahead of the season, and I asked him, you know, from the last time you came up, you know, they made a decent fist of it, but in the end they went down. What, you know, does he think the team's any better placed this time, and what did he learn from that? And he said, you know, basically the aim was to finish in the top 15. He said he didn't want to just call it survival, but he wanted to finish in the top 15. He felt that was realistic, and he thought that what was going to be crucial was starting well. Although they won the league last year in J2, they got off to a really bad start. I've actually done this week's column on it for Football Channel, and now the stat has slipped out of my head, but I think it was something like they only won one of their first 7 or 8 games last season in J2. They really got off to a slow start, and he said if they did that this year in J1, you know, it would be over before it started for them. And they did start reasonably well this year. They drew their first game against Jubilo, then they beat Oita, they picked up a couple of wins against Vissel and Tosu at home, and it looked like, as you said, looked like maybe they had learned from last time and they knew what was expected of them, but they've really dipped off since. The win away to Nagoya at the end of May was the only one in their last 8. They've only scored twice in their last 8, and I asked him again after the loss to Marinos, you know, what are his thoughts now? They've basically taken an average of a point a game so far this season, which probably in 3 of the last 4 years that would have been enough to stay up just. It would have been very tight, but that would have been enough to see them safe. Obviously, last year it took 41 points, and even then Jubilo got 41 and were in the promotion relegation playoff. So if they carry on in this way, it's looking like it's going to be very difficult for them. I asked him after the loss to Marinos, and he said they wanted 20 points. They were kind of aiming for 20 points at the halfway point of the season. They've got a huge game coming up against Gamba this weekend. If they win that, they'll move on to 19. So decent enough. But yeah, when you're not scoring goals, you know, as they're a team that's pretty much built upon having a solid defence. Everyone works hard, and they have got some decent players. They've brought in Taro Sugimoto as well, who did score the winner against Nagoya. They've got obviously Daizen Maeda, if he sticks around and doesn't go to Barcelona B, as the recent ludicrous rumour had it. They've got players that can change games going forward, but as always, you know, you need to be doing it regularly enough. You can't just sort of scrape the odd win and then not win for 6-7 games again. You need to be picking up points fairly regularly. They had the experience 4 years ago, which you'd hope. I also spoke to, I always get his first name wrong. It's Hayuma, isn't it, Tanaka?
Yes, that's right.
I always want to call him Hayumu, but it's Hayuma Tanaka. And he said that. He said, you know, 4 years ago, the club itself was new to J1. He said it wasn't just the fact that hardly any of the players, aside from him, had played there, but he said, you know, the people behind the scenes, the club were not, they'd sort of come from playing in the JFL not that long before, so it was a big step up for them. And he said, look, there's a lot of issues they still need to fix on the pitch, things that he didn't really want to speak about specifically said, but he said, you know, ultimately what they need to do in the second half of the season is not get too bogged down with specifics tactically, technically, all these kind of things, but they just need to realise that they need to be getting the wins, they need to be racking up the points. And I think if they can get in a bit of a run, it's not beyond them. You know, there are enough teams this year that you think could get bogged down into the relegation battle. They're not cut adrift. But I do think, yeah, this game against Gamba could have a big bearing on how the season goes. If they win it, they could move up and, you know, position wise in the table, at least a little bit away from the drop zone. But if they lose it psychologically, the blow of losing at home again, they've only won twice at home, could be a bit of a setback, and it might see them start to drift away. So yeah, this weekend's game I think is going to be a very big one.
I think What struck me the most listening to the press conference after the game and listening to the players after the game was that everyone on the Yamaga side basically saying, well, we did our best and it just wasn't good enough. More or less, I feel like there was a sense that they did play their best, and they did play very well against a Marino side that is known for just having this explosive attack this season, and they shut them down for the majority of the second half. And you know, it's tough, and I think that they're sort of plateauing right now. Obviously, they don't have the deepest squad in the J1. They don't really have too many sort of top class players, if any. And Daizen Maeda is on national team duty right now, so they're sort of between a rock and a hard place. And I agree with Sean. I think a win at home will give their confidence the boost it needs. And if they don't get it, then it's going to be tough. I don't think it's over for them yet. Far from it. But you got to get points at some point in this season, or else you don't want to be in a position where you're fighting to be in 15th, or if you're at least fighting for 16th and home advantage in the J1 J2 playoff.
Most definitely. And when you mentioned that Maeda was missing there, Dan, of course, the injured super defender Yuya Hashiuchi was also absent. He didn't start for the first time this season, so no doubt that played a massive part in Yamaga failing to get a result at the Nissan Stadium. He says that tongue-in-cheek, but Dan, I'll come straight back to you. I mean, we can talk about, you know, the passionate support that Matsumoto enjoy, and the fact that, to quote Ange Postecoglou from his post-game DAZN interview, they worked hard and they were hard to break down. I mean, we can say that until the cows come home, but, I mean, you've got to get goals on the board. Goals win games, and it's a simple fact that Matsumoto have done that as poorly as anyone else this season. I mean, Tosu drew level with them on 8 goals for the season over the weekend. That is the worst tally in J1, of course. And over the course of this weekend, things could hardly have gone worse for Yamaga, with Sendai and Shimizu, who started the match day level on points with them, both winning against the top 6 opponents, and of course a Gamba winning as well to go above them. So, we can segue onto the events on the pitch on Saturday night, Dan. And I mean, you know, one indication of a team struggling for confidence and struggling for goals is when players snatch at chances, and perhaps with a little bit more composure, with a little bit more confidence, might have been able to convert. So in a very entertaining, I must say, first half, there were 3 really good chances for Yamaga in the first half hour. I mean, a couple were ones where, okay, you probably don't expect to score, but with a little bit more composure, you might have thought you would at least hit the target. I'm referring to Hiroki Yamamoto volleying over in the 10th minute. I mean, to be fair to him, the ball wouldn't sit down from him for him, and he had to kind of lash a volley on the jump. But then Eduardo headed over from a corner in the 24th minute. But then the one that Yasuharu Sorimachi will be having nightmares about was the one for Masaki Miyasaka, which skimmed the bar as he fired over with the keeper pretty much nowhere in the 26th minute. I mean, yeah, a team with a bit more confidence, with a bit more going for them at this moment in time, probably would have converted one of those chances. And on the night when, to quote Ange, they were hard to break down, one goal early, I mean, it might have really made a huge difference on the night. But as it is, it wasn't to be.
I think that Miyasaka's post, or he hit the crossbar, and that was probably the biggest miss. If you look at, actually, that was in the 26th minute, and just 15 minutes earlier, Kota Yamada had hit the right post for Marinos, and then Junomano hit the post again in the 18th. So if you're in a situation where Marinos, you know, the home team, in the rain, has hit the post twice, if you get that shot under the crossbar, you have broken them psychologically. But it didn't happen. And it was a well-placed shot. I think that, you know, if he puts a bit, you know, if he hits the ball a bit higher, maybe it goes lower and sinks in. But that was quite an exciting sequence, and it's almost a shame that the match tightened up after that, and we didn't see sort of nearly as many close chances as that.
Yeah, Sean, as I say, it's one of those, isn't it, where, yeah, things are breaking more kindly for you than, yeah, maybe Miyasaka's shot, you know, kisses the underside of the bar and finds the net. But it just, it appeared that eventually Yokohama were going to make Matsumoto pay for their failure to take those chances in the first half. And it did come fairly late on, just 10 minutes from time. But when it did come, the winner from Edgar Junior was very well taken and owed a lot to the determination of substitute Yuki Otsu.
Yeah, it did. I think, yeah, I kind of touched upon it before, but yeah, you can always find moments in every game, you know, if that goal had gone in, this could have happened, or if that goal hadn't gone in, this could have happened. I think that's certainly true. Maybe once you get to one-off matches, you know, if you're talking about a final or, you know, something like that. But I think in this case, the league table very rarely lies. The teams at the bottom at the end are almost always the worst teams over the course of the season. And, you know, if those things are happening often enough that you're not picking up points, it's because either the players just aren't good enough. It's because, yeah, they're feeling the pressure too much and not as relaxed. You know, if they had that chance on the training pitch, they'd probably score 99 times out of 100. It's a case of, yeah, being able to control the emotions and the nerves in that situation and just do what needs to be done. Which, as you said, is exactly what happened then at the other end. I don't even know how to pronounce his name because the Japanese have mangled it completely. Edgy Guard Junior. Just call him Edgar. He's come back from injury and he did exactly that. He had one chance and he took it, you know, very, very good turn. You could ask questions maybe of the defending. Maybe they let him turn a little bit too easily. Maybe they weren't expecting him to do that because maybe not many players in the J League, certainly Japanese players, would think to try and get a shot off there. But when you've got players who are able to think that intelligently and execute things that well in the final third, that is what decides games. Postecoglou was asked after the game by one journalist, you know, this was the kind of game that maybe last year you wouldn't have won or you might have lost. What do you think's changed for you this year? And he agreed completely and said, well, yeah, that is it. You know, last year maybe we wouldn't have seen it out, but the players now have a clearer grasp of what we want to do. He keeps talking about the importance of the difference between their good performances and their bad performances not being so stark. He wants, you know, even if they play badly, he doesn't want it to be that much of a dip in form. And yeah, you're seeing that from Marinos now. They're up in second. If they beat Tokyo next week by, I think it's 3 goals, they'll go top on goal difference. I might have got that wrong.
Well, no, if they win by 2 goals, they'll go top on goals scored because we'll have the same goal difference.
Right, okay. Yeah, so, you know, again, as I said, sort of the opposite way to speaking about Matsumoto, Marinos are up there on merit. They're not there by a fluke. You know, they've put in the results. And yeah, they're doing well. So I certainly think they're in with the chance. That could be the kiss of death because I wrote something about Nagoya about a month ago saying similar, and I don't think they've won since. So apologies to any Marinos fans if I've jinxed it for them too. But yeah, at the moment, they're grinding out the wins. They're playing some nice football. They've got strength in depth. And yeah, things look fairly rosy for them. Whereas, yeah, for Yamaga, it's certainly going to be a slog, I think, over the next 18 games.
All right. Well, we're going to come back to Yokohama in a minute. And there's another question from Patreon about Matsumoto. But I mean, it's pretty funny. The reporter asking Ange about whether Yokohama would have blown that game last season because they blew one of them last week. away at Shimizu. So, I mean, they're still up to their old tricks. It's just happened that, this week they saw the game out. Last week they collapsed in stunning circumstances at the death. But as you say, Sean, I mean, they are second, and they are within grasp of taking top spot next week if they do what is well within their grasps and head to FC Tokyo and win by two goals or better. So, before we move back onto Yokohama, there was another question, as I mentioned, from Patreon, from Brian in California, a Yamaga supporter from afar, and Brian's asking about Matsumoto's prospects basically for the rest of the season. Dan, he asks, with Matsumoto's paltry total of 8 goals at nearly the halfway mark of the season, do any of you, so I'm coming to you first, Dan, see them ultimately accumulating enough points to stay up, assuming for the sake of argument they can hold off Jubilo and Tosu, who are currently the bottom two, of course. Which of the 11th through 15th place clubs do they have the best chance to pass in the second half in order to get to safety?
That's tough. I will say, I think that for Matsumoto, that they do have to get up to 15th, because if they finish in 16th, I would be very confident in saying that they're going to lose to whoever gets out of the J2 playoff. I think that if you look at this J2 this year, it's just a very stacked table, and it's just tough competition. I mean, they might be playing Kashua Reysol in that playoff game, and at that point, it doesn't really matter if you're playing at home or not. That's just an incredibly tough opponent to actually stop stalling and answer the question now that the table is loaded on my phone. I don't know. I think that, you know, it's easy for us to make the joke about them only having to get past Vissel Kobe. But it looks like they've sort of turned things around. I think that Gamba signing Usami today, I guess he'll be able to join the team in a month when the secondary transfer window officially opens. I think that they have to get past Shonan, or maybe, I don't know, maybe S-Pole slip. And I think it's one of those two. I think Vigalto will be fine. Just as defense, that I think that Shonan are, as they tend to do, and I think if you get past one of those teams, you're going to be fine, because Jubilo are horrible, and Tosu are a garbage fire.
All right, fair enough. You're breaking up a little bit there, Dan, but I think we got the gist of your answer. Sean, do you want to have a crack at that? I mean, to me, it looks like the way results have gone in the last month or so, it's definitely Shonan. Both Shonan and Matsumoto have obviously slid down the table in the last month, while Vegalta have won 3 on the spin. Shimizu and Gamba are unbeaten in 5, and Kobe unbeaten in 4. So the way the form book is trending, it looks like it's Shonan to get ahead of or bust. But of course, there is a very long way to go, and all of those sides I've just referenced earlier were very ordinary earlier on in the season, so there's a very good chance they could revert to form fairly sharpish.
Yeah, I think it's still a little early to call. I think form is so important in the J-League. Teams really, really get affected mentally. If they're doing well, they go on a run of unbeaten games, and if they're not, they really plummet. And I think if any of Shimizu, even Gamba, possibly even Urawa, if they were to plummet into some bad form over the last 10 games of the season, Matsumoto are the kind of team who I think would be more steady. They will still be able to grind out the odd win, and I think they'll have that almost sort of underdog aspect to them towards the end of the season. If they're still down there, they'd have, you know, they came up aiming to finish 15th. They knew all season, before the season started, this was going to be where they were going to be at. They weren't going to be challenging near the top of the table. And I think, you know, if, say, for example, someone like Reds were to drop down, or if Gamba's recent revival doesn't sort of catch on longer term, those kind of teams, as we've seen in the past in the J-League, will maybe struggle a little bit more with the pressure of battling against a drop. So yeah, you know, you see Shonan down there. I think Shimizu, Sendai. There's enough teams that are going to be there or thereabouts. None of them, I don't think, are going to pull really clear away. And I'd have to disagree with Dan. I think if Matsumoto did finish in what would it be 16th, isn't it? Is the promotion relegation playoff yeah. thing? I don't really think there's anyone in J2 who's really stood out this year. There've been some, you know, Reysol are a big name, but they've really struggled to score goals this season. They're playing some decent enough football, but they're really not putting games to bed. Almia are unbeaten in about 14 or something now, but they've drawn an awful lot, and again, they're not really scoring. And yeah, I think Matsumoto, you know, although obviously you've got the psychological issue of having finished 16th and the fear of dropping down, I think they would probably have enough quality to beat any of the J2 teams over two legs. Based on current form, but again, yeah, we're looking quite a way ahead of ourselves now, so we don't really know what form the teams down the bottom of J1 or the teams at the top of J2 will be in. But I certainly think all is not lost to them yet, and there are probably six teams in the first division that will be in and around the relegation zone, probably fairly closely knitted together. We haven't got who was the most recent example? I guess maybe Varen last year. What was their points total in the end? They were pretty much.
They were doing decently at the midway point, if I recall correctly. I guess someone like Tokushima Vortis.
Yeah.
Oita, I guess. Their previous J1 yeah. campaign before they dropped down to J3. I mean, I think that, or Sapporo that one season. I see where you're coming from. I don't think. I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll get to Sagan Tosu and their situation at some point, but I just don't see anything positive in that squad. So once Torres leaves, the bottom might drop out.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks very much for your question, Brian. And, yeah, well, I'm pulling for Matsumoto this year. I hope they can haul themselves up the table. And, I mean, yeah, as I've just referenced, the four teams directly above both them and Shonan are embarking on unbeaten runs. So that's motivation enough for Matsumoto to do the same. Yes, we're a neutral podcast here when it comes to FC Tokyo. But yes, if they can get back to winning ways against Gumba this coming Saturday, then that would be just good for football, wouldn't it? All right, before we leave this game, there's another question about the other protagonist in it from Patreon. It comes from Gabriele Anello, and he wonders, guys, if we could tip Marinos for the 2020 title when they'll be able to find a more reliable centre-back to partner Shinosuke Hatanaka. Well, I can let the listeners know that Gabriella posted this question to me before the games took place over the weekend. So, I mean, yeah, we might be facing the fact, Gabriella, that Marinos might be winning the title this year. But, the F Marinos squad, Sean, it appears to be a rolling work in progress, as we heard many times throughout last season, most notably from Scott McIntyre on several occasions, that, you know, this wasn't the finished article in terms of a squad that Ange Postecoglou wanted going forward. There were obviously wholesale changes in the off season, and as Ange's stay rolls on, I'm sure that there will continue to be more changes through each transfer window. So whether centre back is a high profile position that he wants to target in the summer transfer window or not, I'm not sure, or whether he will do some business there in the next off season. But I don't know. Are they ahead of schedule here? We're being 3 points off top as we approach the halfway point of Postecoglou's second season in charge. If Scott was here, he would tell you that they are almost certainly on target.
I think I don't see why not. I don't see why they can't be a challenger this year. Similar to what I mentioned about J2 previously, no one's really standing out at the moment as as the team that is the one to beat. Tokyo obviously have started very, very well, but now they've lost Kubo. Of course, it isn't just losing him, but, you know, it doesn't help losing the sort of key game changer they'd had in recent, maybe in the last month or so, has gone, and they've lost two on the bounce. Kawasaki obviously are a steady team, but, you know, not unbeatable. So I don't see why they can't be challenging this year rather than next year. And the question about getting another centre back in, my worry would actually be that if Hatanaka keeps playing this role, he won't be around next season. He'll be, especially now that he's involved with the national team and, you know, been given a taste of the high life as it is. And, you know, they're in the camps with the bulk of the players are going to be abroad and talking about that. And he's going to start to, that is obviously going to start to rub off on him. And if he gets the offer to go and play for Sintroy then with the rest of them, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he wasn't to go at the end of the season. I think it's so difficult to, in a league like the J League now, where that is the order of the day, you know, you're bringing players through, and if they're young enough and good enough, they want to go straight away. They don't want to wait till they're 23, 24 and then go to Europe. They've got agents, they've got other players around them telling them, or even not telling them, you know, that kind of the unspoken peer pressure of if you're in the national team and 20 of the 24 players are in Europe and you're in the J League, you're going to feel like, I should be in Europe. I don't want to still be playing in the J League. And I think that is now an issue where it's going to be so hard for clubs to plan long term. You can't plan, this is a team we're building for 3 or 4 years, because players are going to go. And I think for Postecoglou, he spoke about that even from the beginning. You know, he said, obviously he uses the term projects and journey and these kind of, you know, almost what's the word, sort of business speak, motivational speak things. But he said he doesn't like to think of, you know, this is the first step and this is it. He wants to be winning while that's happening as well, because, you know, he's a realist and he says he knows if results aren't going well as a coach, you're likely to be fired. The people above you want results, and I think it's those two factors are going to come into play. And yeah, he's going to see this as a big chance now. They're second, they've got a huge game against the leaders coming up. They've been doing well without a few, as you say, like maybe first choice players haven't been playing, or maybe they've been rested. You know, said Miyoshi hasn't been getting starts lately. If you've got that kind of a player, you can bring in if someone else drops out of form. They've certainly got the quality in the squad to make a real challenge for the title this year. I think it would be risky to go, well, we'll see how far we can go this year, and then we'll really make a challenge next year, because, as you mentioned before, you don't know what squad they're going to have. You might have a big turnover again, and then you're back to square one.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks very much for your question, Gabriella. And, it does look like the future is now for F. Marinos. And, the opportunity to go top is in front of them as we hit the halfway mark of the season next weekend. All right, Dan. Well, we've put it off for as long as we could, over an hour into the podcast. But, FC Tokyo travelled up to Sendai in the only game of the match they played on Sunday this weekend. Of course, hosts Vegalta came in on the back of two straight wins, while Tokyo had lost two of their past three, but still enjoyed a five-point buffer at the top ahead of Kawasaki, who were, of course, idle over the weekend. And, Dan, I said to Sam Robson on last week's podcast that I was not pushing any panic buttons. Well, I have mashed it to the point where I've had to take it into the shop and have it repaired today, because Tokyo were pretty abject. And while you can't say much more about Sendai for the first 70 odd minutes of the game up at the Yurtech Stadium, once Kunimitsu Sekiguchi had half a sniff of goal, he put the hosts into the lead in the 74th minute, and that was it for Tokyo.
I knew it was coming. I'm not gonna lie. If you had told me that Tokyo were gonna march into Sendai with Kensuke Nagai back in the lineup and bottle it, I would have absolutely believed you. this is now a team without a runner. It is, this kind of goes back. I think actually, Sean, we may have been, on the pod together. I might not have been us together, but I remember bringing up, there was a Sportiva writer who suggested that if Kubo stayed at Tokyo for the entire season, Tokyo would win the J1. And he's looking pretty smart right about now, because without Kubo, they do not look like a team capable of winning the J1. It's as simple as that. Just without direction, it looked exactly like Tokyo did last year when they were getting pretty close to pursuing Sabetsu Hiroshima, and the gap had tightened considerably. And then they just started to putter out, and they lost all their steam. They lost all the gas. And we've only got 8 home games. Am I correct? I think that's correct. 8 home games. They've got 3 home, 1 away, 3 home, and then the long fall begins. And I think you're right that we should be hitting the panic button, because what?
Yeah, it was pretty pretty dire, Sean. I mean, I must admit I didn't feel threatened at all by Sendai, and I don't know. We often talk about our J League boyfriends on this podcast. Of course, I'm a massive rap for Sean Madoy. We all know Scott McIntyre's affection for Kosuke Nakamura, but in the opposite direction, Kunimitsu Sekiguchi is just one player who I've just never ever rated, and I've never understood him at all. I don't like the look of him. I don't rate him as a player. And the fact that it was him that scored that goal was an absolute dagger in my heart, I've got to tell you, because I don't rate him at all. But it was I must hold my hands up. It was a terrific shot as he worked the ball quickly in front of Seimuroya, and there wasn't much room for a shot, but he placed it absolutely terrifically past Akihiro Hayashi. So that was devastating for me, and also the reaction from Tokyo. There simply wasn't one. And as I say, they've lost for the third time in 4 games. They've failed to score in all 3 of their losses. And Dan's mentioned the return of Kensuke Nagai, and he was lively as he's wont to be. But there's simply not a lot happening. And I've referenced it many times throughout the season. If the loss of a 17, now 18-year-old, is the reason you don't win the league, well, then you weren't very well set up to begin with. But that, I mean, yeah, it's overreaction theatre to you know, 4 games in a month. But Tokyo just look pretty ordinary without him, Sean. And this is, I guess I knew it was all going to come crumbling down eventually. I probably thought that the ride would last a little bit longer, including a trip up to Sendai, who, again, I wrote off at the start of the season. So this was just an absolutely horrible event for me, this game at the Yurtech Stadium. Sendai winning against Tokyo and Sekiguchi scoring, is just I just want to forget about it as quickly as I can.
I hope you feel better for blowing up a bit of steam there, mate.
I need to do that.
I think the thing with Tokyo is, and I've had it all season, I've never looked at them as a team I think can go all the way and win it. I think they've got, when you look at their best 11, their first 11 they were putting out when Kubo was still there and in form, and you go, that first 11 is made up of steady J League players. None of them are bad players, but very few of them are any more than 6, maybe 7 out of 10 players. They're steady J-leaguers. And that is enough to get you, you know, in and around the top 4 or 5. You can make a push for the ACL. I mean, you know, you've seen the teams that are in the ACL this year. Urawa and Sanfrecce are nothing to write home about. But I think when you're talking about winning the league, you do need, you need players that are something different, that stand out and are doing it consistently. You know, you don't just want someone who every so often is capable of doing something, which you could argue that, you know, several of Tokyo's players, Diego Oliveira has his hot patches, Kensuke Nagai every now and then will do something and hit a run of form, but they haven't really got anyone. You know, if you look at, say, Kawasaki, and they've got Kengo Nakamura, Ienaga, Kobayashi, you know, they've got these kind of players. Kashima maybe at the moment are not, maybe not the team they have been in recent years, but still the likes of Serginio, the likes of Abe, the likes of Doi, Leo Silva, you know, they've got these players that are kind of a cut above in J1, and I really don't see any of Tokyo's first 11 as that. And then you've got the issue of once you get into the backup players, they just haven't really got the quality to come in. Kubo's a bit of a deceptive one because, the fact he's gone now is a big blow. He was really clicking into form. He was really getting confident. He looked stronger. He looked better. But how much of that was him knowing he was off and he was going back to Europe and he was going back to where he felt he belonged and he should have been the last 4 years if it wasn't for the issues with Barcelona and them not being able to keep him. And you know, but you can't pin too much on that because Tokyo were willing to let him go on loan to Marinos last year. They obviously didn't rate him highly enough and think he was ready. So I think what they've got now is this issue of, you know, they put all their eggs in they pretty much played with almost the same 11 every week. Once you lose one of those players, the one who was in form, who do you bring in to replace him? And they've got that kind of all over the pitch. You know, if Hayashi was to get injured, is the backup keeper going to come in and be steady enough? If Morishige was to get injured, if Takahagi was to get injured, or Diego Oliveira, who comes in and picks up the slack? I just don't think they've got enough outstanding players. You kind of touched upon the fact that you had a sneaking feeling Usami might come back. Someone like that, although I'm not his biggest fan, I think he's one of the examples of kind of the wasted talent that Japan has, not the wasted talent, what's the best way of putting it? A talent who hasn't taken full advantage of the ability he's got to really kick on. Someone like that coming in would add something a little bit different for the J-League. So I think if they really want to stay in the title race, I think they do need to try and bring somebody in just to add a little bit of spark, something a little bit different, because I think, you know, once you know how to play them, they haven't got a plan B or something different. And I think maybe now we're getting to that point where, yeah, as you said, Sendai, you weren't really threatened. They never really looked like doing much, but they know how to defend against you. And then they get the one goal and suddenly that knocks Tokyo for six. And the second goal was, you know, a sort of bolt from the blue and it just killed the game. So I think, yeah, they need something to liven things up if they want to make a real challenge this year.
If I can cut in and sort of add to Sean's point about Tokyo not really having any sort of even domestic marquee players, like Kengo Nakamura, like Yu Kobayashi, can any of us really close our eyes and imagine Keigo Higashi lifting the plate at the end of the season? Like, who are we kidding, folks? Like, Keigo Higashi is not going to be the captain of the J1 champion. Like, what are we doing here? Like, I think as soon as that decision was made, and certainly, he's a step up from Jang Hyun-soo, whose respect I completely lost after his little military scandal. But Keigo Higashi, really? Like, this is the best we could do? This is the player who's going to lead the revolution? I agree with Ben what you said before. Like, if your hopes and dreams hinge on a teenager, like, you're playing on borrowed money to begin with.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've mentioned Higashi there, Dan, and Sean, you wondered what would happen to Tokyo if, say, Morishige or Takahagi got injured. I was wondering if we could organise an injury for Higashi, because I'd like to see what would happen to Tokyo if he was removed from the equation, because, yeah, basically, since he's become captain, he's an automatic start every single week, and that is a... Well, yeah, I mean, Kenta Hasegawa has obviously done extremely well to get Tokyo to the top of the table, but that is one decision. I just have failed to understand from the moment it was made. But, yes, anyway, Ramon Lopez did finish off the 2-0 win for Sendai, and that is now three straight wins for Vegalta as they move themselves up to 11th in the table. So, I didn't want to take anything away from the victory that Sendai enjoyed, but yeah, as a Tokyo supporter, an extremely frustrating watch, obviously. And good luck to Sendai going forward. They actually do we do play the return of this game in the next month or so, I think. Sendai are visiting FC Tokyo in the big block of games that the Gasmen have at home before the Rugby World Cup gets up and running. So what this result does, allied with the previous game that we talked about, Yokohama beating Matsumoto, is that indeed we do have a top of the table clash in prospect at Ajinomoto Stadium on Saturday night. It's the top two, Tokyo on 33 points and a goal difference of plus 11. Yokohama have 30 points plus 7, but Yokohama have scored more goals this season, so a 2-0 win or better will take them to the top of the table. And that buffer that Tokyo enjoyed for a few weeks there has all but evaporated. But Tokyo, after Yokohama, they also play Gamba and Kawasaki at home in a row before travelling to Shimizu. That is their only away game in their next seven in the league. They then host Cerezo, Sendai and Hiroshima in match day 23 before eight in a row on the road. So, Ajinomoto Stadium is going to be a fascinating clash this coming Saturday night when Yokohama visit the leaders. All right, guys, we have been going for well over an hour and a bit here, so let's kind of try and wrap up the rest of these games. And Dan, it sounds like you're on the mean streets of Tokyo tonight, so if you do need to leave us at any time, please just give us a heads up, and no worries at all.
I found an alleyway to buy my time, so I'm just sort of chilling. And actually, it's nice because it's a breezy 20 degrees, or 19 for once in Tokyo. So I'm enjoying this cool weather before the humidity destroys us all.
All right. Terrific stuff then. All right, so it sounds like you're with us for the duration, Dan, or at least until you get attacked by a pack of wild dogs down that alley. So we'll stay in touch with you, and hopefully everything will work out okay. Before we finish up, we'll move on to the only game of the match day that was won by a visiting side, and that is Shimizu S-Pulse, who suddenly are the late game heroics specialists. For the second straight game, Kenta Nishizawa has bobbed up with a stoppage time winner after doing the trick at home against Yokohama last week. He's doubled his fun and netted the winner for Shimizu in their 2-1 win away at Nagoya. Dan, this was, I can't say this was a result we saw coming, because Nagoya had been wobbling and Shimizu had been getting the job done, but S-Pulse had been doing it at Nihon Daira. So to go away from home and take a fairly big scalp in the shape of Nagoya, who were fifth at kickoff, that's just done them no harm at all as they haul themselves up to 12th.
Certainly not. Hell of a way to win a game. And Nagoya are a team that we thought that after last season's woes, they had sort of started to get it back together, and they're almost there. And I know that our good friend of the podcast, Adrian, is probably listening to this and screaming into a pillow. So, sorry, Adrian. Not your week, not your month, not your season.
No, not at all. So, Grampus now 5 without a win, and the S-Pulse are 5 unbeaten, 3 of those victories. And as I say, Sean, winning away from home is a bit of a change for S-Pulse. And, I don't know, is this a precursor of a proper push up the table for S-Pulse? I mean, Sam Robson has said throughout the course of the season he's felt they were in a false position, but they have been very calamitous defensively, but far and away the worst defence in J1 in terms of goals allowed. But I don't know, do you think they might have started to right the ship in that regard? And as they did last year, they might be able to haul themselves up towards a mid-table obscurity by, you know, with quite a few games left to play?
Yes and no. I think they have been in a bit of a false position, and I don't think they deserve to be right down near the bottom, but I don't think they've got enough to be looking much higher. I think they'll be there or thereabouts. I think they'll be one of those teams we'll be looking at even in sort of round 30 where we'll go, they could be caught. They only need one win to make sure of safety, but they might have needed that one win for two or three games. I think they've got enough quality there to avoid going down, but I don't think they've got enough overall to really push much higher. So, yeah, I think they're one of those teams who I kind of touched upon earlier. They go through spells. They'll not win for five or six, and then they'll not lose for five or six. And I think they'll quite happily coast through this season as well, doing something similar. Yeah, you know, to win the last two games against the opponents they've beaten, and also the way they've done it, shows they've clearly got enough about them to get the points they need. But yeah, I just don't think they're enough of a team to really push on much higher. So I think they'll be safe eventually, but they won't. I don't think they'll pull themselves clear too far before the end of the season.
All right then, but yeah, Kenta Nishizawa quickly making himself into a folk hero amongst the S-Ball supporters, I'm sure, with those two late winners in consecutive games. So we're terrific stuff for S-Ball, as I say, as they haul themselves up to 12th. And when we've talked about Nagoya in recent weeks, they've always come in unison with Oita because their results have mirrored each other. Well, in this J1 match day 16, Oita finally worked themselves above Grampus, and that is thanks to a 2-2 draw away at Kobe. So the Thorsten Fink magic only lasted for 1 week. Of course, he got his tenure off to a winning start away at FC Tokyo last week, but it was almost two from two for Fink, only for Trinita player Seigo Kobayashi to level for Oita with a minute of the 90 left, and a terrific finish it was with the outside of the foot. That came after fairly calamitous goals, it must be said, in the first half hour. David Villa scored for Vissel in the 6th minute. Ado Onaiwu equalised just 2 minutes later, and then Wellington put Kobe back in front in the 26th minute. All three goals came as a result of horrible mistakes at the back, basically, and pressure from the attacking team against the defence paying off, and the attacking team taking advantage of those miscues from the defences. So I don't know, Dan, not a lot to take away from here, but I guess Oita showing real spirit to hang on until the end and finally grab a point at the death, and as I say, go above Nagoya, albeit, I mean, Sapporo went above them in this match day, so they didn't improve their spot in the table at all, but another indication, I guess, of the progress that Oita have made throughout the course of the season, when they can grind out a point in a game like this where it looked like their time was running against them.
I think about the 2008 season where I think they conceded 24 goals and finished in fourth. They conceded less than a goal a game. And if you had told any of us watching back then that Trinidad would be keeping up with Vissel Kobe for a 2-2 draw in 2019, we'd have all thought you were out of your mind. They've been very impressive this season. My first look at them in person was the loss to FC Tokyo, and even so, I think they held up fairly well. As far as Kobe are concerned, I don't think that Fink's magic has quite worn off yet, because I think that with another manager, this is a game that they probably would have lost. This is exactly the kind of game where they would give up the 2-2 and then a 3-2 in the 6th minute of stoppage time. So, full credit, he's still unbeaten in two games, and that's not very easy to do for a mid-season foreign managerial replacement.
All right, Sean. Well, let's move on to talk about, as I said, the team that moved above Trinita and indeed Grampus in the standings and up to fifth, and that is the Sapporo in the only game played on Saturday afternoon at a windswept and very rainy Atsubetsu Stadium up in Sapporo. The host Consadole won 3-1 over Tosu. They led 2-0 at halftime with both goals coming from Lucas Fernandez corners, Naoki Ishikawa and Jay Bothroyd netting for Consadole. But Tosu halved their deficit with 20 minutes to play. Amu Kanazaki netting for the first time in the league this season. But with the retiring Fernando Torres left on the bench, and we'll come on to him in a moment, Sapporo made sure of the 3 points with 6 minutes left when Musashi Suzuki finished off a rapid Chanatip-led counter-attack. So, obviously, Tosu remained rooted to the foot of the table with their third straight loss, Sean. But Sapporo back up into the top six now. And, they're still obviously within touching distance of not only the ACL places, but indeed top spot with Tokyo dropping two games on the spin. So things starting to look a bit rosier for Sapporo after we questioned whether they'd really made much progress after their fourth place finish last season. Well, here they are back up into fifth and, looking at pretty good value. It must be said, Tosu were fairly limited on the afternoon, but they did make it interesting, as I said, with 20 minutes or so to go. And Sapporo saw the game out fairly well. A positive result for them, all things considered.
Yeah, I think we've covered the likes of Kobe and Tosu and what the issues are with their recruitment a fair bit already this season, and I think Tosu are really they're really a kind of just floating along without any real idea of what they are or what they want to be right now. The fact that Torres has decided he's had enough and he's not even going to see out the season. You could see it in a sense of go, you know, fair enough. He's realized he's not able to contribute anymore and he doesn't want to just stick around and take up a squad, place in the squad. But you could also say, you know, the fanfare that these players are bought in with and all the nonsense they spout about the project and all this stuff when you know they're there for the money and they wouldn't have been there 2 years ago when the DAZN cash wasn't there is a little bit galling. But yeah, the team is not especially good. And they will be, I think, struggling down at the wrong end of the table till the last rounds. And Sapporo, are one of those as well who, rather like Tokyo, I think they'll be there or thereabouts. They'll be up in the top six or seven. They'll always be within striking range of the Champions League spots and wouldn't be a huge surprise if they made it. They've got a good coach. They've got enough quality in the team to do a, you know, a decent job in J1, but I don't think they've really got enough to push on. I don't think they've got enough quality throughout the squad as a whole to really push on and make a concerted challenge for the title. You saw here, it was a good team beating a not very good team. It was fairly standard J1 fare.
All right, Dan. So we've touched on Torres there with Sean. I mean, he tweeted on Friday that he was going to have a press conference to explain the reasons for his retirement on Sunday morning, Japan time. I wasn't expecting that he would make the trip up to Sapporo, but he was included in the match day squad and indeed was an unused substitute. Where Fernando Torres is going to be remembered in a lot of places around the world for a fantastic career. But apart from people who have gotten to know him around the training pitch at Tosu, perhaps, and the supporters of Saigon Tosu, I mean, he's not really going to be revered at all for what he's done in the J-League, is he? I mean, he arrived, as Sean's mentioned, in a DAZN-fueled fanfare, but he really hasn't been able to contribute much at all to Saigon, and he's pulling the pin, and the impact he's had, I don't think really Tosu are missing out on much.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the idea of this DAZN-fueled fanfare, because it's really DAZN and the J-League who are happiest about Torres being in the league and them being able to capitalize on his international popularity and use him to market the league, because basically all of the J-League international marketing has centered around Fernando Torres and Andres Iniesta. When they do air games overseas on DAZN's international versions, for example, now on Rock 10, odds are that the games are going to be either Missile Kobe or Southern Pilsen, or both. And I just don't get any of it. This idea of him becoming an advisor to the club after he leaves, like, it's cute, and I suppose it is a sign of respect that he's choosing to retire as a Southern Tosu player, whereas he could have gone back to, you know, to Liverpool to sign a one-day contract or something ridiculous, or Atletico Madrid, and to do something silly like that. But, I mean, that would be his prerogative. And just look at watching the press conference, seeing DAZN's logo all over everything, the backdrop, the mic he was using. It was all just so stupid and cynical, and I'm probably going to write about this for my Japan Times column this week. I'm still sort of forming my thoughts, but it's silly, and what has it gotten Tosu? Their front office has a hard reputation amongst their fans, who are practically in open rebellion, and they're going to spin this into a two-month farewell tour and turn a league game against Vissel Kobe into, like, this big retirement thing? Like, are they going to start him on the bench and then bring him out for a standing ovation, or bring him out in, you know, the 60th minute or whatever? It's dumb. It's a scenario that we could have all envisioned when Torres and when Iniesta joined the J-League. But to see the league and to see the player and to see the club actually stoop to this level is rather disheartening, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, have DAZN had a say in what his last game's going to be, do you think, Dan? I mean, yeah, it's Torres versus Iniesta, it's Tosu versus Kobe on the 23rd of August? I mean, have they told Torres that they want him to hang on until that game so he can bow out by playing against Iniesta's team?
I wouldn't be surprised if Tosu and maybe the league and maybe DAZN sort of begged in a manner of speaking, Torres to stay on until that game. And that's a Friday night game at Ekibai Real Estate Stadium. Keith was about to call it Best Amenity for a second. It's going to be a lot of pomp and circumstance. They might even toss the broadcast to NHK because, of course, it'll be a big match nationally. And, yeah, I mean, it's good in a way that the J-League can now boast games of this nature that are important enough to broadcast nationally. But at what cost? Like, it's all just so cheap and manufactured, and I don't like it. Don't like it at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, massive kudos to Fernando Torres on a spectacular career, and no questions asked. And, I mean, I must admit, I was extremely excited when he did make the move to Tosu. But, yes, it simply hasn't worked out. And, he'll plod along, and he might make the bench, and he might come on for a couple of minutes until that finale on the 23rd of August at home against Andres Iniesta and his Kobe side. And we'll just wait and see what happens in the meantime. All right, we'll wrap it up, guys, with the last two results from match day 16. Again, an abbreviated version with the four ACL teams not playing, but you wouldn't know it by the length of this podcast. It was a terrific match day for both of the Osaka clubs. They both won at home, but in very contrasting circumstances. Cerezo handled Iwata 2-0 at home, thanks to goals from Bruno Mendes and Kota Mizunuma. But over at the Suita City Stadium, Agumba brought all the drama, and they left it late indeed. Dynamic young forward Ryotaro Meshino, he the scorer of a couple of terrific goals already this season. Well, he might have scored the best of them, probably not quite the best of the ones he scored this year in the league, but it was a terrific goal, right-footed across the keeper inside Yota Akimoto's far post. And considering the timing and, yes, the magnitude of the 3 points for Gumba as they hauled themselves out of the bottom three, that might just have been Meshino's most important goal to date. So, Sean, yes, both of these Osaka clubs, as I say, with a very fruitful match day. Cerezo travelling the better as they edge themselves into the top half of the table. But Gumba now a 5 unbeaten, and well, they've been drawing too many games for their liking, I'm sure. A win like this, with a Matsumoto next on the schedule, of course, as we've mentioned several times in the podcast, that could help them to nudge up towards a mid-table themselves.
Yeah, I think Gamba was a team, when I spoke to you, what was it, 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago maybe, and we were looking down at the bottom and who did we think might be able to push on. We tipped them as one of the teams that were probably too good to be down where they were. You have to give credit to Miyamoto, because he has brought through some young players and stuck by them when the team was struggling. He's realised that the likes of Endo and Konno are not perhaps the players they were. You know, they're both now in their late 30s, and they now seem to be bench players and playing in the Levan Cup, and he's trusted in these youngsters who, for all the rights and wrongs we have of the under 23 teams playing in J3, who have been able to get regular minutes in proper competitive professional matches playing in their under 23 team and then being bumped up. And yeah, I think, yeah, if unbeaten in 5, yeah, obviously they, you know, though sometimes those kind of runs can be deceptive when you take into account the amount of draws thrown in, but I still think psychologically for teams, knowing you can hang on and pick up the points is good. Scoring against a team that's down there with you in Shonan, scoring a winner in the 91st minute to take the 3 points is only going to help to boost their confidence even more. So, as we mentioned earlier, as you said, we've mentioned it a few times, that the game against Matsumoto is going to be huge. I think Gamba would probably be happy enough with a point away. They obviously don't want to lose it, but I think even if they were to lose that game, they're easily good enough to kick on now and make their way up the table. And yeah, it might only be mid-table obscurity, but I think that will be, they'll be more than happy with that after where they were a month or so ago.
Indeed. And Dan, I wonder whether Gumba supporters should be enjoying Meshino while he lasts. Obviously, with Gumba a hotspot for dynamic young Japanese forwards who tend to make a move over to Europe at a very young age. I'm talking about Takashi Usami and Ritsu Doan. Of course, I wonder if Meshino is going to be the next cab off the rank, because he certainly announced himself with some terrific goals already this season. He's certainly got a lot of growing into his body to do, I would say. He's certainly not the finished article physically, but he's very dynamic. He's certainly got an eye for goal, and I wonder, if it might nearly be Usami in, Meshino out in this summer.
I feel like Gamba are at a point. They're not a team that needs to be a selling club. It just, in terms of how they run their front office, I think they need to hold on to every single talent they have this season, because it's obvious that they're struggling and could get caught in the relegation race. And in that position, I don't think you want to give up anyone who's having a positive effect on your results. So I think that you can keep him for the rest of the season and then maybe try to sell him in the winter. I think that makes more sense from a tactical perspective.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so that is our wrap of the 7 games from J1 Match Day 16 played over the weekend. Obviously, the highlight of the Match Day 17 fixture list is FC Tokyo hosting Yokohama in the top of the table clash at Ajinomoto Stadium, 7 o'clock on Saturday night. The game that we've referenced several times, Matsumoto hosting Gamba, is the other game on Saturday, while the other seven games will all be played on Sunday, with the four ACL teams also in action. As I mentioned, Kashima hosting Hiroshima for the third time in, 10 or 11 days on Sunday. All right, then. So before we leave, though, we did have one more question from Patreon, guys, and apologies to Sam Robson. Hopefully we won't gloss over it too quickly, but Sam asked, with the mid-season transfer window approaching, which teams do you think need to do the most urgent business? So I'll go first. I would suggest, for one, FC Tokyo most definitely need to go some way towards replacing the offensive input that Takefusa Kubo has, is now out of the team with Kubo gone. And obviously at the foot of the table, you're looking for goals from the likes of Matsumoto, Iwata, and Tosu. So whether they can go into the market and, I don't know, perhaps find this season's version of Douglas. Sam's a big shout from last season when he joined Shimizu, and who played a massive part in Espol's finishing well up the table last season. Whether one of those teams down towards the bottom has their scouting network in action and can find the next Douglas. But I don't know, Dan, I'll throw it back to you. Which sides need to do the most business in the transfer window, do you think?
You more or less took my answers. I think that Tokyo desperately need a replacement for Kubo, and Matsumoto definitely need a striker who's capable of scoring more than one goal. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that no player on all of their eight goals this season have come from eight different players. If I'm incorrect on that, apologies, dear listeners, but you know, even so, the most any of them have are two goals, and that's just not enough. They need a scorer. They need a Douglas. They need a Patrick. They need to find a remarkable Brazilian who can come in and wreck things in the second half of the season. I'm trying to think of who else really has desperate needs. Tosu need how many players?
Yeah, probably need one of everything, don't they?
Yeah. Pegalta are going to need a new goalkeeper to replace Daniel Schmidt, but it looks like they're already on that. Tough. I mean, there's nobody. There are a few other teams that have like a really glaring need. I think that there are certainly some clubs that there isn't a club out there that can't be improved with a top caliber player. I sort of wonder if Urawa aren't going to try to make a move during the window, which isn't really their modus operandi, but given the state of the club so far this season, maybe it's time for a change.
Yeah, what do you reckon, Sean?
Yeah, likewise. I'm looking at the table, and Tokyo needs something to, if they really want to make a push for the title, they need something to happen, something to ignite them. Matsumoto, maybe. I think they've always been a side that are built more upon their team play rather than having any outstanding individuals. I mean, last season they won the league with Takasaki as their kind of main striker, and he's not an especially prolific centre forward. Reds, I think Reds are just such a mess of, they've got so much in the squad. Oliveira just seemed so reluctant to actually use a lot of them and mix things up. He was going with the same 11 pretty much every week, regardless of the fact they weren't doing very well. I think they've probably got enough in there. They need to enliven things. They've got the likes of Nabal and Martinez who barely get a look in to throw in and add something different. And then, yeah, the rest of the league is much of a muchness. They've got, you know, most of them have got enough steady players. You look down at Tosu, and again, they've got enough in the squad. They've got enough players who've been around and know what it takes to stay up. And Torres going doesn't really change anything. He's barely played all season. He's not scored a goal all season. It's not like with with Tokyo losing Kubo, where you're suddenly taking out the guy who's been in form and winning games for you. So I don't think they need to worry too much about losing him. I'd have to go with you two and say that the two who really need maybe something, some kind of activity, is Tokyo and Matsumoto.
Yeah, fair enough then. And thanks for the question, Sam. Although I suspect Sam probably only posed it because he might have had a sneaking suspicion that I was going to reference his shout about Douglas from last season. But if that is indeed the case, Sam, very well played, my friend. All right then, guys. Well, as I said earlier, it was an abbreviated round of J1, but certainly not an abbreviated episode of the podcast. Sean, great to have you back on. Thanks so much for your time.
No worries at all, mate. Always a pleasure.
And Dan, always great to speak with you. And yes, I look forward to doing so again soon. Thanks, mate.
Absolutely. Thank you for having
me. Okay, then. That is it for the J-Talk podcast for another week. And my thanks again to Dan Orlowitz, Sean Carroll, and our patrons who submitted questions. Of course, you can support the podcast as well by heading to www.patreon.com/JTalkPod. All support is greatly appreciated. So yes, thanks to our patrons for their questions, and of course, thanks to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review the top of the table clash at Ajinomoto Stadium and the rest of J1 Match Day 17, and hopefully, if they're still involved, Japan at the Copa America and the Women's World Cup. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.